Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He is an assistant professor in American foreign policy at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. He's author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speer, and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So This is a story that takes us through, obviously, this guy Hans Speer, who you're going to explain to us in a minute. He's the sort of pre-Henry Kissinger in some respects, of the kind of European exile who sort of set the model for this influence in American foreign policy. But we could think of the sort of brand names: Henry Kissinger, Zeb Brzezinski. There's an interesting history here, and let's just start to work it backwards a little bit. We go to Trump, and you know, certainly the perspective of this show is one of a much more structural critique of U.S. foreign policy that transcends partisanship and has a lot of bad things to say, and maybe just analytic things to say about both Republican and Democratic administrations. Now, that said, you know, the Trump administration has earned the brand, and rightfully so in a lot of ways, of basically being messy, melodramatic idiots who despise, you know, expertise. And, you know, in the Bush era, we had all of these, and this is all my editorial, fanatics who pushed for things like invading Iraq and a global, you know, war on terror and implemented torture regimes and all the rest of it. But they did have this sort of appropriate training according to the standards of the establishment. And now we have, you know, this is the Gorka administration. But that being said, if we pull the lens out a little bit wider and look at John Bolton, we can actually trace that all the way back to the rise of the defense intellectual and Hans Speer and the story you're telling. So maybe situate this a little bit, and then we'll dig into the history of Hans Speer and Rand Corporation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's important to stress first that there's been a lot of talk about how Trump is anti-expertise and yep. his administration is anti-expertise. But I think it might be more accurate to say that he's drawn on alternative expert networks as opposed to rejecting expertise. So, for example, Gorka has a PhD, right? Even though it's a PhD from not a particularly august institution, as far as I can tell, not within the United States, but he does have a PhD. And even someone like Bannon is someone who fancies himself an intellectual. Mm-hmm. And of course, he had H.R. McMaster in, and who himself has a PhD in history. And Bolton, of course, is himself a defense intellectual. So I think rather than to say Trump has totally rejected expertise, he's drawn on non-establishment, except with regards to Bolton and McMaster. But in some part, his administration represents a blurring of establishment expertise and the sort of alternative establishment expertises mm-hmm. like Gorka and Bannon. So there's all of these elements here. So I think what's important to see is that across administrations, from the Obama administration, where you got people like Anne Marie Slaughter and Samantha Power, and the Trump administration, where you have people like Gorka and Bannon and McMaster and Bolton, and of course, in the George W. Bush administration, you have people like Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Doug Feith, and all these other PhDs in the administration, you could see that these academics, these so-called defense intellectuals, have been permeating the U.S. foreign policy establishment, at least since Iraq. And what my book shows is for much longer than that, and that this was actually a conscious effort amongst intellectuals to become part of the foreign policy establishment. And what my book really shows is that this impulse to become part of this establishment began in the 1930s and 1940s and was actually a response to this which is pretty interesting, a left-wing response to a skepticism about ordinary people's ability to make wise political decisions that emerged from people both in Germany, people like Hans Speer and Kissinger, but also people in the United States observing the fact that many of Germany's workers and ordinary people actually supported Hitler. So this demonstrated to a generation of intellectuals that they couldn't trust people, and that in order to save democracy, they ironically needed to become part of state institutions in which they were allowed to influence foreign policy without the oversight of Congress or the public. And this becomes this anti-democratic goal that they institutionalize in places like the RAND Corporation, which is a focus of my book, and that allows people like Kissinger and Condoleezza Rice, but also Francis Fukuyama, Rose Gottemuller, Bernard Brody, Albert Wallstetter, and many others to leave academia, enter these para-state institutions like RAND, and eventually move into the government itself.
So let's start from the beginning. Who is Hans Speer, and how does this, just basically take us through who he was, and then, you know, through that hit those themes you're talking about, from the reaction to Hitler's rise in Germany to these political and intellectual developments in the United States.
Sure. So Speer was basically a guy. He was born in 1905 in Berlin. He came of age during the Weimar Republic, which is the famous German liberal democracy that eventually falls to Hitler in 1933. And ironically, as a young man in his 20s and into his mid and late 20s, he was an avowed socialist and actually a left-wing socialist. And what he argued throughout the Weimar period was that intellectuals like himself needed to educate Germany's workers in order to teach them how to navigate the new institutions of Weimar democracy, right? Germany is a monarchy until 1918. Germany loses the war, and it becomes this new liberal democracy called the Weimar Republic. And Germany's people, who are first enfranchised in the Weimar Constitution, at least Speer worries, they don't have the skills necessary to really navigate these institutions, large trade unions, a newly empowered Reichstag, et cetera, et cetera. So what he wants to do is he wants to use his intellectual skills in order to teach workers to manipulate the levers of power directly in this new democratic government. But what happens to Speer, and indeed many people in his generation on not only the right, but also the left and the true blue socialist and communist left, is that over the course of the late 20s and early 1930s, they become very disenfranchised with Germany's workers because, at least as they see it, workers supported anti-democratic political movements. On the right, they supported the Nazis, and on the left, they supported the communists, because the communists, like the Nazis in Weimar, didn't like democracy. They wanted to establish a dictatorship of the proletariat and the Leninist guys, et cetera, et cetera. So what this convinces Speer, especially after Hitler comes to power in 1933, this convinces Speer that you're not actually able to rely on ordinary people to defend democracy, which is, of course, what at least his understanding of Marxist theory predicted. Marx said that as societies, or at least as people interpreted Marx in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, people like Bernstein said that as societies become more democratic, workers would support socialists, the socialist movement, and this turned out not to be the case. Mm-hmm. And so what this convinced people like Speer was that during a moment of crisis in which democracy faced an existential threat like the Nazis, intellectuals couldn't actually rely on ordinary people, but instead had to join state institutions and create the policies that would save democracy for the future. So the way I put it in my book is that they wanted to save democracy from the people for the people. And this is what they did.
And is there also a parallel lane of, because I'm these people start emigrating to the United States, but I'm also thinking of people like Walter Lippmann, people in American right. context who are also writing, and you talk about him as well, who are also setting up the parameters and the frameworks, presumably, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're upset about sort of some of the public rejection of Wilson's attempts to sort of formalize international institutions. And there is this reaction to, well, you know, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, we just can't have ordinary people influencing it. Now, you know, in that context, there's, you know, very little attention paid to the fact that maybe ordinary people were quite upset about the World War One and the catastrophe and incredible body count, which they had to pay the price for, which is obviously another, you know, theme that runs parallel to this. But what I'm saying is, are they able to, they have this trauma, and then they are able to come here and glom on
right.
to a tradition in America that's already these sort of like technocratic mediators of democracy. So maybe like, you know, people with interest in public opinion polling and, you know, how to manage the populace. They can have influence, but it needs to be in tight parameters.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. So on both sides of the Atlantic, in the United States and Germany, intellectuals are dealing with the new technologies of modernity, things like mass communication technologies like the radio. You're able to easily print newspapers. And it's ironic in this age of Twitter, people today worry about everyone having a voice. This is exactly what the guys like Speier were saying in the 20s, yep, that to print news magazine, it was so cheap that anyone could have a voice, and this actually hurt political discourse. But what happens is in the United States, this journalist and intellectual Walter Lippmann writes this book called Public Opinion, these two books, Public Opinion and The Phantom Public, in which he argues that the fact that British propaganda was so able to easily manipulate ordinary Americans into supporting the United States entry into World War I demonstrated that people were easily manipulated, and that what you needed to do is you had to reframe traditional democratic theory, which argued that every American citizen would be able to know enough about public affairs to guide foreign policy in a modern age, because modernity was simply too complex for the average person to understand. And this was demonstrated by the fact that they were manipulated during World War I. So one, modernity was too complex, and two, people were easily manipulated. So what Lippmann argued is that you needed intellectuals to join. He called it something along the lines of an organization connected to the state that would be able to make the facts known upon which policy depends to those who have to make the decisions, or something along his lines. So Lippmann basically advocated creating a think tank in the early 1920s, well before the first modern think tanks were created in the 50s. And so what you have is when the exiles come to the United States in 1933 and beyond, after Hitler comes to power, is that they're able to enter into an American conversation that was already skeptical of democracy. But why the exiles are particularly important is because they serve as literal physical embodiments, yeah, of what happens when ordinary people are allowed to run rampant in a democracy, right? They're over time, they're at the most elite American institutions. They get recruited into World War II organizations like the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, or the Office of War Information, because the United States needs experts on Germany. So they become a very powerful symbol to Americans about what happens when you let ordinary people really take the reins of government. So this is what they do, and why they're so important is because they give a physical presence to Lippmann's claims, right? They're totally navigating these institutions in the United States, and you're hearing German, literally you hear German accents in all of these powerful American institutions. And so it convinces Americans that they really can't allow this trauma the trauma of Weimar to repeat itself in the United States. And I think one of the most powerful examples of the fact that these exiles had such a resonance in the United States is the fact that Kissinger, even though he came here as a pretty young child, never lost his German accent, right? And the famous line is Kissinger never lost his accent because he never actually stopped long enough to listen to anyone. But the real reason is that he recognized that it was a way to get cultural currency in the American foreign policy establishment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Exactly. It's total branding. And he still sounds like he just came out of Germany, even though he's been here for the overwhelming majority of his life. And so this is what the exiles are really able to do.
Right. He should sound like an old guy on the Upper West Side by now, not like he's, you know, like kind of like ushering you into a concert in Vienna or something in 1925.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. So that's perfect. And that takes us up to, you know, the 40s and even, I guess, if my reading of this, I mean, obviously you could see all of the landmines and the problems that are in place in this, and as well as the ones that I love that are, you know, that are being repeated now. I mean, the fake news conversation, yes, is fake news and propaganda, corporate and governmental, a major problem? Of course. The solutions that are, you know, the technocratic solutions that are emerging from places like Facebook actually are very jeopardizing of also what could be, you know, very important and legitimate investigative journalism, right? I mean, if you're so these themes are all alive. But getting back to our story, so World War II is happening. People like Speer are moving inside the defense establishment, inside really an emerging defense establishment and the, right, you know, intellectual culture of America. Then after World War II, this is going to start to get formalized. And later, I mean, I have some actually some maybe some more sort of broader contextual questions of how these people fit in and maybe some broader material causes. But in terms of just the story, is this when Rand arises? Like what the creation of the Rand Corporation, and is this the same interest in creating institutions outside of a democratic process and a fascination with connecting any sort of latest trend, and whether it's, you know, cybernetics or game theory, you know, to give a scientific veneer to these processes. And then I'm assuming, you know, of course, this then leads into Vietnam and linear body counts and Ford Motor Company modeling and McNamara and all of that.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. So what's really important to emphasize is that when people like Speier are arguing for this anti-democratic program in the 30s, where you just need to ignore public opinion and enter the state, is they're saying that this only needs to happen during what they call a moment of crisis. Right. Democracy is facing this existential threat with the Nazis. And when you defeat the Nazis, basically democratic life could return to normal, or at least this is what people like Speier were arguing or implying in the 1930s. Nevertheless, what happens after the war, of course, is that the Soviet Union gets one far more powerful due to the war. They become a true challenger to the United States on one hand, and on the other hand, in 1949, they get nuclear weapons. And so what this means is that for Speier, the crisis that had defined the 1930s, which was what he considered a moment of crisis, transforms into an era of crisis. So you can no longer just have ad hoc associations like there's a war, and then you're recruited into the government, and then you go back into academia. But with the rise of a nuclear-armed Soviet Union, that is, with the rise of a permanent existential challenge, you now need permanent or institutional solutions to the problem of public opinion that Speier and Lippmann had identified earlier, right? And so what you're looking for are these institutions like RAND that enable intellectuals to make foreign policy totally outside the public's and Congress's purview. So that's where Speier comes at it. But on the other hand, during World War II, you have all these intellectuals like Speier, and more importantly, probably scientists, physicists, et cetera, entering into the wartime government. And a bunch of military officials around 1944, 1945, particularly in the Army Air Forces, the Air Force was an independent unit yet. It was still, independent branch of the military as part of the Army. What you have is that after in 1944 and 1945, they're worried that all of these eggheads are essentially going to return to academia, and they want to maintain their services because they're similarly anxious about the rise of the Soviet Union as a threat to the United States. They want to build world leadership. So what you so they want to build these institutions, but they also don't think that intellectuals are going to want to stay in the military, right? Because who would want to stay in the military voluntarily? So what they do is they this guy, General Henry Hap Arnold, who was parodied on The Simpsons as General Henry Hap Happablap, if anyone remembers that episode. So, but this guy, General Henry Arnold, basically gives $10 million private corporation, the Douglas Aircraft Company, and Arnold and Donald Douglas, the head of Douglas Aircraft, are actually in-laws. So you see this total embeddedness of the U.S. elite at this moment. But what Arnold does is he gives $10 million to Douglas to found a private research organization, which they dubbed the RAND Corporation, which is an acronym for Research and Development, in which ostensibly private employees working, I would even say early on, solely on government contracts, would be able to offer advice to the military and the government without being subject to any congressional or public sanction, right? So from the very beginning, you have the expansion of the U.S. state. You essentially have the outsourcing of foreign policy research for the U.S. state to to pseudo-state institutions like RAND, where intellectuals are able to offer advice totally without paying attention at all to public opinion. So what this does is that it essentially institutionalizes the anti-public or anti-democratic program that Speier and Lippmann had advocated for decades in think tanks like RAND. So these think tanks then become permanently mobilized to fight the Cold War. And of course, unlike in the 30s, the Cold War is from its very beginning set to be a decades-long conflict. You have one by 1949. Both powers have nuclear weapons. No one wants to fight a nuclear war. Also, no one wants to fight a third world war. And over time, you have the emergence of a relatively stable bipolar system. So what happens is this: what is a moment of crisis in the 30s, right? Once the Nazis are defeated, democratic life could return to normal. After the war becomes an era of crisis in which these anti-democratic ideologies are institutionalized, not only in places like RAND, but in places like the CIA, the National Security Council, which is essentially a body meant to manage America's world hegemony, and which is totally outside the Congress's or the public's purview, right? It's only through the National Security Council, for example, that Kissinger gets into power, and recently Bolton gets into power. These are institutions that are not subject to public accountability. So what you see in the late 40s in the foreign policy making sphere of the American establishment is the institutionalization of an anti-democratic ethos. And in fact, sorry, yes.
No, finish your thoughts. Go ahead.
I was just going to say you could even see that what I would call a liberal, because Speier and all these guys fancy themselves liberals. They were very much not on the right wing. Speier only voted for Democratic Party candidates the entirety of his life. What you see is this becomes a part of liberal discourse when you really can't trust people. And you see it still after the Trump election, yep. Right? Everyone, right. You know, quote unquote, what's the matter with Kansas? And that famous New Yorker cartoon that was going around with a guy standing up in a plane saying, "Let me fly the plane." And of course, every liberal reading the New Yorker was laughing at that. Right. But what it really showed is that there's this embedded distrust of the public that emerges from this moment pre-1945, this traumatic experience with fascism that still resonates in the American imagination, as you can see through the constant use of Hitler analogies.
Absolutely. So let me kind of introduce a couple of other variables into this that are not contradictory. They're supplemental, and you allude to them. So it seems like a couple of other things. I mean, one thing that's also going on that I think we can, you know, that I'm also interested in for you to touch on moving forward is that I feel like now, you know, in the creation of this system, the role of the private sector was subordinate in some ways to, you know, to a governmental parastate foreign policy. And obviously those two things were very connected. There was always this shouldn't be a cliche. Eisenhower did warn about a military-industrial complex in the 50s, and it's a very literally a real thing. That's actually one of the sort of more concrete things in American political discourse and political life. You can see it in budgets and in foreign policy. But, you know, moving forward, I'm interested in how, as the role of the private sector got more and more powerful, so that we can even, you know, tell this story of Iraq. I mean, it's, you know, it's two catastrophes and horror. It's this, you know, invasion, which was totally wrong. But then it's also a story of privatization and contracts. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested. And you could see these defense intellectuals, at least as it became, more fully conservative, but I would say you could still include democratic, foreign policy thinkers in that as well, that the parallel ran with a broader sort of marketization and neoliberalization, and you saw it applied to foreign policy, and that applies to everything from, you know, privatizing Iraq's, electrical grid to Blackwater. And then the other thing, and you could just take these. I just want to put these ladies out for you because I like how, you know, you put them both together. It also seems to me that the other thing that's happening in the 40s and 50s and 60s is that the United States has to manage a paradox. And a lot of, you know, scholars have noted this, but they have to manage that. Okay, first of all, Britain is winding down and U.S. and the United States is going to take over that sort of U.S. empire role. But it's going to be different. It's not going to be a traditionally colonial one in the way that Britain is, right? It's going to be colonial through bases and through commercial arrangements and through, you know, keeping the lanes of commerce clean and clear. But it's not going to be through the official, you know, the sun never sets on the British Empire, right? I mean, you could argue that it doesn't set on the American one either, but it's not, it's different. It's an evolution of that model. And then there's the paradox that as that model's evolving, it's like, okay, well, on one hand, there's even this rhetoric of, you know, we're a democracy and we're supporting decolonization, but then at the same time, we need to make sure that there is no policies that are contradictory to our, you know, commercial interests in our zones of influence. And oh, and by the way, you know, we're going to develop this parastate apparatus that will, you know, instigate coups, overthrow democracies, organize death squads everywhere from Indonesia to Guatemala as part of the basic power play. So is it also, and I guess we can move to the privatization later. I should have brought that up later. But is this also another thing that's going on, that you need this sort of grid of thinkers that can not only keep foreign policy out of the public, but also start to justify the contradictions? Because in some senses, these other colonial enterprises are much more, you know, they might be hypocritical, but they're coherent, right? Like, you know, the Soviet Union, we're going to put the Red Army in and stamp down the rebellion, and that's what the party says, and that is what it is, right? And then in the United States, it's like, well, on one hand, we're going to have the United Nations and blah, 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 blah. And then on the other hand, oh, whoa, Jacob Arbenz is going to hurt United Fruit, you're gone. And you need to create that, you know, so it seems to me that there's also the intellectual function that's needed for that. And that's, you know, Kissinger, obviously. I mean, that's theories, balances of power. All of these nations and people and principles are totally subservient to an abstracted chessboard that he saw the world through, and people in that lineage, if that makes sense.
No, that makes absolute sense. I'll take the last part first and then go back.
Yeah,
to the
sorry.
Beginning.
In any way, I gave you a lot.
No worries. It's great stuff. And I think you're absolutely right. So it's also at this time, it's important to point out that the idea of national security between the 30s and the 50s becomes an actual thing. And national security, much like the economy and its idea, becomes a thing because it becomes an object of social scientific analysis because it's something that you're able to manage, right? And this is why I see the creation of these sorts of institutions that many on the left today critique. It's actually emerges from the early progressive project, capital P progressive, in the 19th and 20th centuries, which was to use experts to manage both political economy in the United States and eventually world affairs in the 1920s and beyond as the United States becomes more involved. So you have the creation of this object of analysis that intellectuals like Speier, intellectuals like Kissinger are able to analyze. So what's interesting here is that you can see how these progressive projects, which is to manage things for the public good, become instantiated in anti-democratic ways due to the peculiar experiences of the first half of the 20th century. So Speier wasn't an idiot. He understood that it wasn't democratic to, for example, overthrow Mossadegh in Iran in 53 or overthrow Arbenz in 54. But he argued that in this moment of crisis, remember, the Cold War is imagined as a permanent crisis, that actions that were previously considered extraordinary were able to be undertaken. So intellectuals like Speier, through arguments like that, are able to provide intellectual succor to what I term in the book an ideology of intervention, and the idea that the United States is able to intervene abroad when, where, and how it sees fit, because it had demonstrated in World War II that it was the only hope for democracy to survive going forward. So what you have here is this total imbrication of progressive politics and what we would consider an anti-democratic or conservative foreign policy, which is a peculiar thing that happens in the middle of the 20th century. And with regards to the first question about the military-industrial complex and everything else, what people forget about Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he talked about the military-industrial complex, that was only the first warning. The second warning was what Eisenhower termed, he was worried about what he termed the scientific technological elite. So at the very beginning, Eisenhower links the military-industrial complex to the scientific technological elite, of which Speier is a part, because they reinforce each other. So the weapons that are being built by the military-industrial complex are justified by the intellectuals like Speier, who argue that the United States needs to have all the power possible in order to defeat the Soviet Union, which they perceive as an existential threat to democracy. And it's important to emphasize here that it's really the trauma of the 1920s and the 1930s that leads people to embrace this perspective. It's hard for us to consider today how traumatic Nazism was to a generation of intellectuals, especially a generation of Jewish intellectuals, because, of course, it's only in the late 40s that Jews are really able to enter the previously WASP foreign policy establishment. And so for these people, the World War II and the Holocaust are really influential. It's not surprising that so many foreign policy intellectuals, all the greatest ones, the Albert Wallstetter, Kissinger, Walt Rostow, Schlesinger, Bernard Brody, all of these guys are Jewish, because it was in the 20s and the 30s when they were coming of intellectual age and they saw their people almost exterminated by the Nazis, a Nazi threat that the United States might not have confronted, that they become really worried about not only democracy's survival, but the survival of their people. So there's a reason. These guys weren't just evil, I want to stress, which is what a lot of the literature had treated them as, but they had this really important trauma, which helps lead them, to this particular political position. And just to get to your final point about sort of the privatization of all these things, the way I would see it is that they're singing the same song, the same anti-democratic song, but they're singing a different tune. So you have in the 50s and the 60s, during the sort of New Deal stage of the American state, the outsourcing of a lot of governmental functions to pseudo-state institutions like RAND, where they're nominally private, but they work solely on government contracts. And they're subject to some sort of governmental responsibility. But over time, as neoliberalism becomes much more of the ideology from the 1970s forward, you have the anti-democratic ethos transferred from pseudo-state institutions like RAND to totally private corporations like Blackwater and things along those lines. So again, this is outside the public's and Congress's purview. So the anti-democratic song is the same, even though the tune of pseudo-state versus totally private institutions is slightly different. So you could see, as I see, and I think a lot of people are showing from 1945 onward, is that there's been a general anti-democratic trend in a lot of areas in American life. So people have focused on very much with mass incarceration or the denial of voting rights, the recent gutting of the Voting Rights Act. And what I show is that this was also true in the foreign policy making process, in which the public currently has almost no say. I mean, you could see after all the protests for the Iraq war, where nothing happened and no one listened to it, it's just the public is not considered to be a crucial stakeholder, ironically, because they're the ones who are fighting and paying for the wars in American foreign policy. So what I think is a lot of scholars are showing that since 45, America has become progressively less democratic in certain significant ways. Of course, this doesn't always hold true. For example, the civil rights movement was critical to getting procedural rights, you know, the right to vote to previously oppressed populations who are, of course, still oppressed. But in a lot of areas, what it means to be a Democrat in America changes from a substantive ideology where people have social, economic, cultural equality to a procedural equality that once people have the right to vote, their democratic responsibility is done, and now you let the experts rule.
Right, absolutely. So then that sort of leads, I mean, as we sort of, you know, move towards sort of summing this conversation up, but I think that this is, I like it because this is another area where there's just so many parallels to draw across so many areas. And of course, I've revealed maybe my, you know, the political biases that I have are, you know, zero surprise to anybody watching this show. But I think that, right, so that Trump, I mean, his election, that experience was this major shockwave against a certain type of technocratic expertise and a certain type of expectation about how the world works that elite people on both sides of, you know, that sort of brand signifier have. And not to say, I mean, of course, people know I certainly thought it was, you know, it was Hillary Clinton was the right and necessary vote in that scenario, but broader and structurally.
Same here.
Yeah, right. I mean, so we can, you know, hold all of these thoughts at once. But that being said, and then there's this backlash that we talked about in the beginning. And it's funny because, you know, to me, the appropriate backlash is everything from, you know, the just sort of rank immorality of the whole enterprise to the incorrectness of the policies pursued by Republicans to the baselines are really a fundamental disagreement about how the world should work. It isn't, you know, it's not a math problem. I think everybody should have health care,
exactly.
And I think the United States should not be killing civilians in Afghanistan or Somalia. And that isn't a procedural argument. That's a baseline argument.
And it's a question of values.
It's a question of values. And that is the fundamental anchoring. And
exactly.
And so much of the response, and I think we also got conditioned, particularly if we're in our, if we came of age during the Bush era, and that was the game, was, Bush lies or some Republican says something dumb, then John Stewart throws to the objective source that debunks the stupid lie, and then you make a face, and then everybody laughs. But that's over. I mean, it's both over and both over and it doesn't get the job done. So, but at the same time, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I want Daniel Bessner. I would prefer you as a foreign policy advisor to Sebastian Gorka, first and foremost because of our values, but also because I do think that sort of knowing what you're talking about is relevant and, being able. So I guess what I'm saying is, how do we capture that balance between basically the crude populist backlash, which is, I agree, it's not actually embodied by Trump, but it's tapped into by Trump and Alex Jones and all the other hucksters of our age and salespeople and so on. But then at the same time, not fall back into this other lineage, which might have started with some very understandable, horrific trauma and noble motives. I have to give one dispute on that list. I'm going to maintain, I think Kissinger is evil, but maybe that's a conversation for another time, but certainly not these other guys. Right.
Yeah.
And there's
Kissinger was also younger.
Yeah. Kissinger was, I think there's a real depreciating return on the specific, it's like when you talk about Israel, okay, what you did in the 40s is I'm going to look at a very different lens than 2018. But all of that being said, how do we strike that balance between honoring the role of social science and expertise, but also renewing democracy and making the critique really be one of values and not procedure?
I think that's a great question. And just briefly on Kissinger, he's kind of an outlier here. He was a bit younger and all of these different things. So he's not quite included in the Speier group, just to make that very clear. But I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it leads to the general, takeaway of the book, which is that when Speier and all these other intellectuals were uniting with the military and government to create these institutions in the middle of the 20th century, they never once considered the notion of expert accountability. They either assumed that the experts would police themselves or that the government would naturally police experts if they gave bad advice. But the problem is that this didn't turn out to actually be the case. So you have experts, they're terrible in Vietnam. They lead to this disastrous war, which leads to the death and destructions of millions of Vietnamese and their lives. And of course, hundreds of thousands of Americans are negatively affected by the war, and it doesn't really do anything. But even though there's this very brief backlash to Vietnam, by the mid-1970s, the experts are back in power. They're still guiding Reagan's foreign policy and Carter's foreign policy and Clinton's foreign policy. And they're the ones, people like Wolfowitz again, help lead to the Iraq war. So I think the first thing to do is to establish a system, or at the very least a culture of accountability, so that when someone like Wolfowitz, when they contribute to the Iraq war, they're not just able to leave the government to become president of the World Bank. And then when they resign from the World Bank, they're not just under disgrace. I believe he slept with his secretary or something along those lines.
Like
so when
that,
they resign from when they resign from the World Bank, they then just can't go to a sinecure at the AEI. And when Jeb Bush runs for president, Wolfowitz can't go to his foreign policy team. There needs to be some sort of accountability in this culture when experts contribute to absolutely horrible policy decisions. And if you don't have that accountability, then people, of course, are going to distrust the experts, because they should distrust the experts because they gave us Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the other experts on the Democratic side gave us Libya.
Yep.
So a number of other ones that I can mention. So I think you need some sort of expert accountability. I mean, you see it today when Reince Priebus was just given a visiting assistant professorship at Harvard. Right. At least when Walt Rostow, who was the national security advisor under LBJ and had some very horrible decisions in the Vietnam War, at least when he left government service, he couldn't get a job at MIT or Harvard. He had to go to the University of Texas at Austin, which is a great institution, but it's not where Rostow necessarily wanted to be. So I think you need to have these people not being rewarded for contributing to horrible decisions. And the elite itself has to take that responsibility unto itself to ensure some accountability, because without accountability, expertise becomes degraded. People don't trust it because they are right not to trust it. And then you can't bring knowledge to bear on foreign policy. And I do believe that thinking long and hard about something, it should be valuable, right? Now, with something like foreign policy, it's not a science. There's a lot of art, but still, I guess I reveal my cards here. I do think it's worthwhile to have people who have thought long and hard about the subject in positions of power that are able to hopefully provide some good advice. And if they don't provide good advice, then they shouldn't be allowed to provide advice in the future. And I think that is what is completely lacking in our political culture right now. In essence, we need to be more democratic, not less democratic. People like Speier wanted to answer the gamble of democracy by essentially removing that gamble, by saying that the public shouldn't have much influence. I think what we need to do is contribute, if we on the left agree with this, I think we think experts should be a thing. I think we need to contribute to a political education, this very broad idea of helping people understand the world in which we live from the perspective that we see it, and which will also in the end give some more faith to experts who are actually responding to the public's idea and public opinion.
So maybe also just a little bit of Japanese values as well. No, I'm just kidding. Where is the shame? Daniel Vesner, the book is Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. It's a fascinating book, and I really appreciate your time. I look forward to more conversations.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.